Where are the sun's sibling stars? Could binary star systems have Lagrange points? And do galaxies have different generations like stars? All this and more in this week's Question Show. Welcome to the Question Show. Your questions, my answers. As always, wherever you are, across my channel, if a question pops in your brain, just write it down. I'll gather them up and I'll answer them here. All right, let's get into the questions. Gerald Hartman, 2336. Is it true that 85% of star systems are in a binary star system? If true, what are our chances of having a sister star? What kind of star could it be? Where is it? All right, so first, there's a bit of a misconception in there, which is the 85% of stars are in a binary star system. Because there's an argument about this, but the evidence seems to be leaning that that is very not true. But a safer thing to say is that the majority of sun-like stars or sun-mass stars are in multiple star systems. And the majority of the heavier, brightest stars are definitely in multiple star systems. Binary systems, trinary, up to eight. There are some pretty crazy star systems out there. But the vast majority of the stars in the universe are actually red dwarf stars. And they are mostly singletons. They're mostly by themselves. And so, in fact, the majority of stars are alone. But because the sun is one of these sun-like stars or larger stars, then yeah, it's a little strange that the sun isn't part of a multiple star system, but it's not a deal killer. Where is our binary partner? Well, you know, there's no guarantee that we need to have a binary partner. And a binary partner star can cause mayhem. So astronomers are starting to find all of these free-floating objects in the Orion Nebula. And one of the leading theories of where these are coming from is that you've got binary star systems that are interacting with each other, and they are kicking out planets that were part of the formation process. And so maybe it's good that we didn't have a binary star companion. Now, can we rule out for sure 100% that we don't have a binary companion at the beginning of our time? No. There are plenty of three-body interactions that could cause stars to drift apart. And in fact, when you think about the star-forming regions where stars come from, they start as this giant cloud of gas, and then various pockets of gas collapse down. You get these star systems starting to form, and the stars are interacting with each other, and they are, in some cases, tearing them apart and drifting them away. And then over time, the entire star cluster just spreads out and just forms part of the Milky Way, and it's almost impossible to say, you know, where are the stars in that. Now, it used to be impossible, and now it's mostly impossible, extremely difficult, and that's thanks to the Gaia mission and others. But what Gaia allows you to do is to be able to look at the motions of all of the stars that are flying past and start to realize, oh, all of these stars are in some kind of stream. So maybe that was due to the Milky Way colliding with some dwarf galaxy billions of years ago and tearing it apart and turning into the stream, or a smaller stream. Well, there is a group of stars that were once part of a cluster and starting to be stripped apart and are still moving together as a group. And so astronomers have looked for stars that not only have motions that you could have it be in similar orbits to the sun's formation, but also the chemical composition of the sun. And there's at least one star that is considered to be a sibling of the sun. It probably formed in the same star cluster, same star forming region. It probably, you know, was relatively close to that other star. But in fact, there's like a news story that just broke today as I'm recording this. So it'll be like a week old when you see it. And that is that astronomers tracked the motions and the chemical compositions of all of the nearby star clusters, about 150 star clusters located within about 3,000 light years of the sun. And really the ones you can see, like if you have a small telescope and you look in your telescope and you look at a really cool open star cluster, that's one of these clusters. And when they calculated the chemical composition and the motions, they figure that they come from three different star-forming regions in the Milky Way. And so, in fact, all of the clusters that you can see probably started in just only three different star-forming regions. So imagine an Orion Nebula and then two others. So where are the siblings? I mean, there's probably dozens, if not hundreds, of stars that formed with us in our star-forming region. And where are they? They are somewhere out there in the Milky Way, moving in an orbit that's kind of similar, and they've got similar chemical composition to the sun. But they could be on the other side of the Milky Way now, thanks to all those gravitational interactions. I'm sure you noticed the Star Trek planet name that appeared above my shoulder. Now, normally Chad makes a joke when I get the wrong one, but he doesn't seem to do that anymore. Wonder why. Anyway, this is a way for you to vote, for you to tell us what you thought was the best question of the week. And so everybody voted. And last week, the winner was Agent Dark Booty. Why do the plumes on Enceladus exist in the first place? So thank you, everybody who voted for that question. So we will have a different planet name that'll appear above one of my shoulders. And then you can, at the end of the video, just in the comments, put in the planet name that you like the best. This is like a way to know if you watched the whole thing and to tell us what you thought was good and what was bad. So we'll put the names into the show notes as well as like along the timeline, and then we'll count them all up and we'll celebrate next week. Frederico Nito, are there any galactic events powerful enough to disrupt all solar systems in that entire galaxy, maybe kill all life on any system? Asking to get inspired for a sci-fi novel. Thanks. You're asking for recommendations for risks that extend out beyond the planet itself, something that could be a galactic risk. And there aren't many of the galaxy are big and there's a lot going on in a galaxy. And so a gamma ray burst could destroy dozens of star systems that are caught in the beam of the gamma ray burst. But that's, you know, that's nothing. That's no damage whatsoever to a galaxy. Supernova going off, no big deal. Galaxies colliding and merging and lots of star formation, it would look barely any different than what we could see. So I think, you know, something that would be dangerous at a galactic scale would have to be something that's intelligent, like maybe runaway von Neumann probes or Berserker probes that are on the way to take over giant chunks of the galaxy, or someone is using the, you know, someone intelligent is using technology at a galactic scale to cause harm to a galaxy. So they are accelerating stars at, you know, they're doing gravitational slingshots of stars around black holes and then firing them at another galaxy. But even that, you know, you're just going to be firing a star that's going to pass through a galaxy. It's not going to do any damage. So a mad experiment that turns the universe into strange matter and the bubble of this destruction is expanding at the speed of light, that would be bad. But that's kind of the equivalent of a sphere of berserkers, von Neumann probes that are expanding out and destroying all life within some sphere radius. So I can't think of anything that would be like a natural disaster at a galactic level. And, you know, there's always this idea of vacuum energy that in fact, you know, we're not at the lowest energy state of the universe, and that the universe could drop down one more level and that would then tear apart the universe. And again, you would get this bubble that's going outward at the speed of light, but it's like, it's really hard to react to something that is approaching you at the speed of light. Everything is fine. Now you no longer exist and you had no way to predict it, no way to spot it coming. So, I can't think of anything that doesn't come from some kind of malevolent intelligence. Of Garnelo, does the Earth-Moon system have Lagrange points? Does the Moon-Lunar orbiter have Lagrange points? Is it Lagrange points all the way down? So, does the Earth-Moon system have Lagrange points? Absolutely. Have you ever heard of the L4 Society? Have you ever heard of Gerard O'Neill's giant cylinders floating at L4? That's the Earth-Moon L4. So just like the Sun, right? Earth and the Sun, you've got 5 Lagrange points. 3 that are directly in line between the Earth and the Sun, and then you've got 2 that are ahead and behind the Earth in its orbit. And that is due to the gravitational interaction between the Earth and the Sun. The Sun is dramatically more massive. It has to be 25 times more massive than the smaller object. And so the Sun is definitely 25 times more massive than the Earth, and so you get Lagrange points. And same thing with the Earth and the Moon. The Earth is dramatically more massive than the Moon, and so you have 5 Lagrange points, and they are 5 separate. So they are the Earth-Moon Lagrange points. And none of them are being used today, although there's like a Chinese relay satellite that's on the far side of the Moon, is kind of in the Earth-Moon L2 Lagrange point. And people thought about ideas about using a lunar elevator that could lift payloads off of the surface of the Moon, and that would maybe use the Earth-Moon L1 Lagrange point. And so you're asking, like, okay, so if the Sun and the Earth have Lagrange points, and so if the Earth and the Moon have Lagrange points, then do the Moon and some spacecraft that's orbiting around the Moon have Lagrange points? And Like, I guess theoretically, yes, in that, you know, when you consider what is a negligible mass compared to the mass of an orbiter, it's going to be something on the order of a couple of atoms. So you can imagine there could be theoretically an atom or two that could be stuck in the L4, L5 Lagrange points around the moon and the orbiter. Moon orbiter L4 Lagrange point. But you're very close to the Earth. And so you're going to have all of this gravitational tug of war happening from the Earth. And so it could very well be that nothing's going to remain stable. But practically, no. It has to be, you know, significantly, you got to have a significant mass, a less mass, and then you could have an insignificant amount of mass that is caught in the Lagrange point. Kitty and Shadows. Do binary star systems have Lagrange points? If so, does that affect where the planets orbit them? You have to sort of think about the kinds of setups that you could have for your star systems to figure out whether or not you're going to have some kind of Lagrange point. So let's imagine we've got two stars that are orbiting one another and they are absolutely identical, and that there are no other stars, no other planets, there's no other gravitational interactions in their vicinity. And so then those two stars are going to be orbiting a common center of gravity, right? And so theoretically, if you put a spacecraft right in the middle, then it would be able to maintain that position with very little fuel. But the second that it started to drift a little bit, you know, maybe one of the stars puts out a flare and that causes the position of the sort of center of gravity to move a little bit, then the spacecraft is going to drift a little bit. And then now it's caught in this oscillation. And then it's going to be falling down the gravity hill and crash into one of the stars. And that's impossible, right? Because you would have to sort of set up this perfect universe. But it's also a great way to think about what a gravitationally unstable Lagrange point is going to look like. Imagine then you added, say, a Jupiter that is orbiting both of these stars. And so now this planet is going around, you've got the two stars going around. And so this exact perfect balance point is now a blob that is changing in its shape over time. And so there's no way the spacecraft can remain in that position. And so instead, it's calculating its position. It's going, okay, here's where the stars are, here's where the planet is, this is the shape of the Lagrange point, here is the center now of the gravity blob. And so it would fire its thrusters, put it back into that position, and now it's going to be able to maintain that position with the minimum amount of fuel. You know, it's going on this kind of little orbit that sort of matches the planet that's going around it. Now, you can imagine a version of that system where you've got two stars that are orbiting a common center of gravity, and then you go really far away from them so that it's as if they are a single object. You could just treat it like a single object. You don't have to worry about them orbiting around each other. And then you're going to get Lagrange points. And so you could have, say, a Jupiter-sized world that is like the distance of Jupiter away from these two stars that are orbiting each other. And then it's going to have Lagrange points exactly like you would have in the solar system. And so it really just depends on the distances. If the stars are, you know, if you're too close to where the stars are, then everything just all turns into a mess. But if you're far enough away, then things start to settle out and balance out. And yeah, you could have Lagrange points around a binary star system. Jaff Geo Wef Geo 3F9034. Fraser, please say, sorry about tomorrow's process. There you go. Sorry about tomorrow's process. Why did you switch from Star Wars planet names to Star Trek planet names? Thank you. Yeah, so when we first started the show in the first year that we were doing these planet names to get the votes and so on, we used Star Wars planet names. And then because I like Star Trek better than Star Wars, I put my executive foot down and said, no, let's switch to Star Trek planet names. And so for this year, we've been using Star Trek planet names for the entire year. But I'm going to put my executive foot down again, and I want us to switch to Stargate planet names next season. And so probably, if we all remember, Chad write a note, we'll switch to Stargate planet names next year. Not my name. Are there different generations for galaxies like there are for stars? I've heard some galaxies are inactive. Are they older? Huh, that's really interesting, because when you think about a star, you can have an individual star and you know that it's made up of the different generations of material that came together, that you had those initial population 3 stars, they detonated supernova, provided heavier elements, they're kind of mixed into the batter. You've got kilonova, you got neutron stars colliding with each other and releasing heavier elements, and that's mixed into the batter. I don't know, this is turning into some kind of cooking analogy, but anyway. And then you've got regular main sequence stars, and they are blowing off their outer layers, and they're firing out maybe, you know, atoms of helium and maybe carbon and oxygen, and that's getting into the recipe. And so when you have a star form, it's going to have this mix of these heavier elements. But galaxies pretty much are from the beginning of time, that there are no new galaxies that are forming. All the galaxies that are around that we see today, they're all pretty much as old as the universe itself. The Milky Way is essentially as old as the universe. But different galaxies can be at different stages of the process of the, you know, of the activity process. And so in the beginning, early on in the universe, there was tons and tons of the gas that was required to make stars. And so just a couple of billion years after the Big Bang was called cosmic noon. And this was this time when the most active star formation was happening in the universe. And so like now the universe is winding down, but back then galaxies were just ablaze with star formation. And you see plenty of these examples. And then you get galaxies like the Milky Way, as I said, starting to wind down, but still has regions of star formation that are inside of it. But then we see what our future looks like. And so our future is something like M87, like one of these giant elliptical galaxies where they're the final result of spiral galaxies crashing into each other, all of their gas clouds meeting and mixing, forming all the stars, using up all the fuel, all the raw material in the galaxy to make stars. And then the thing just cools down and settles out and all the stars turn red and eventually it'll just fade away to the background of the universe. And that is the future of the Milky Way when we merge with Andromeda and the galaxy and Triangulum and the rest of the galaxies in the local group. So you don't get those generations of metallicity in the way that you do with stars, because stars are sort of forming and dying at different times in the age of the universe. But you do get these different phases, and you definitely are getting certain amounts of enrichment of metals. Things are starting out with low amounts of metals in the universe, and they're building in the amounts of metals that they have in them over time. Kid with one shoe, what is the meaning of life? I mean, obviously, we can give you the quick answer, the 42. But, you know, I'll give you some dad advice here, right? Or at least someone who I think has had a pretty good career and had a lot of fun. Obviously, we don't know. There is no objective answer to what is the meaning of life. So it's something you're going to have to figure out for yourself. But I think what I've learned is that there are things that you enjoy, there are things that are fun, and there's things that make you sad. And if you can figure out how to remove the things that make you sad, then that leaves more of the time for the things that make you happy. And I think that's it. I think you want to live a life where you're happy, where you make other people's lives happy, where you get to learn and experience interesting adventures, and you are as kind and helpful to the people in your life. So good luck. It's a journey we all have to take for ourselves. Scientist baffled. Why does everyone seem like AI evangelicals lately? It's overhyped marketing. I think like overhyped marketing is where somebody has made something that has really no practical value, like Bitcoin. Zing. Even Bitcoin, okay, maybe theoretically there's some value, but NFTs are a great example where you're just like, what is the point of this? Why are people spending this kind of money? But AI, like in its current state, AI has practical value. I don't know about you, but I use it all the time. I use it for figuring out recipes. I use it for planning trips. I use it for organizing text documents, doing data analysis. So I use it for helping me understand the content in very technical science papers in a way that I can actually report on it. So right now, today, AI is providing practical use to me as a journalist, as a, you know, husband, chef, all that kind of stuff, you know, in a way that NFTs cannot do so. And then you look at the kinds of capabilities that are coming out in terms of, say, protein folding, like what AlphaFold is doing. I just have an interview that's coming out in a couple of days where we talk about how they're biologists that are using they're working on types of biology that can be used to make living on Mars easy. How can we use biology on Earth to remove perchlorates from the surface of Mars? And they are using things like AlphaFold to be able to look at the kinds of proteins they need to be able to produce and find out through this gigantic database to find out which are the ones that are going to be most helpful. So, you know, to say that it's overhyped marketing is partly correct. I mean, it sure feels like a bubble, but that's kind of like saying, you know, what's with this World Wide Web? This feels like overhyped marketing. Well, it was, and yet also it wasn't. And I think AI is going to be the same thing, which is that it is clearly there's something there. There's some there. And so all of these giant companies are rushing in, they're spending enormous amounts of money to try and figure out what the there is. And yet we're just at the very beginning of understanding how we can use this technology in ways that are safe and valuable and safe and also not harmful, but also safe. You know, like I have a lot of worries about how this technology can be used in harmful ways. So it's funny to me how people will say, this stuff is useless, but I'm worried about it destroying the movie industry, causing enormous amounts of mayhem in elections and things like that. Like something that can cause mayhem in election markets, in elections, is powerful and, you know, something you need to be concerned about. So I think it's totally a bubble. Some people are going to make money, some people are going to lose money. But there's something definitely there that is worth understanding deeply to figure out which parts of it are good and which parts of it are bad. I would never let AI write anything for Universe Today. Never. It's terrible. It's garbage. But I would definitely let it brainstorm with me 20 ideas for good explanations to the Fermi paradox. And then I'll go from there. If you want to support the work we do at Universe Today, consider joining our Patreon club. Your support lets us have a minimum of ads and no sponsorship messages. Patrons get no ads on UniverseToday.com for life. Want the extra parts of the live stream that aren't in this edited version? You can sign up for a special patron-only podcast feed and get the overtime segments as well as other special behind-the-scenes episodes, including our monthly patron-only question show. And thanks to everyone who's already subscribed, and welcome to our recent newcomers, Henry Nivaluk, Copper Core, James Kerr, Laura Silvestri, Mystic Fish, Gregory Goldstein, Sean Fullard, Matthew Crampton, Lee Gustafson, Stargazer, Headcrab, Gravity Wells are for suckers. Join the club at patreon.com/universetoday. Faisal Sahar, how does the observable universe's size compare to the possible extent of the entire universe beyond what we can see? And what implications does this have for our understanding of cosmology? So, we don't know how big the actual universe is. We know from our observations and our calculations that the observable universe is about 93 billion light years across. And that is sort of, if you take 13.8 billion years ago, a place that was on one side of a volleyball and a place was on the other side of the volleyball, right? These two points on the sphere. And then you come back 13.8 billion years later and you measure that distance again, you get 93 billion light years. So that is the size. Imagine the sphere. And it is centered on you. And a different one is centered on me. And those are different observable universes. But we know that that is, you know, that is not the entire universe, that there was that volleyball-sized universe, but there was probably another volleyball-sized universe right beside it and another one right beside that. And in fact, we would know, like if the universe was just the volleyball-sized universe that we're in, then we would measure this curvature to the universe that would tell us the size of the universe that we're in. In the same way that if you're standing on the Earth and you look out and you see the horizon, this clear curve, you know, if you're standing on Phobos, you would be able to measure the size of Phobos just by measuring the shape of the horizon. But if you're on the Earth and you can't measure the shape of the horizon, then the Earth is bigger than what you can measure. And you have to have some other way to be able to measure the size of the Earth. So how big is the universe? We don't know. We don't know. You know, it is at least like 1,000 times more volume than the universe that we can see. But at a certain point, you're like, it might as well be infinite, right? It's finite, but bigger than we can imagine, or it's infinite, it goes on forever. What implications does this have for our understanding of cosmology? I mean, it doesn't, because if we are in a universe that is infinite, that's weird. But if we're in a universe that's finite, that's also weird. And so I think practically, for the kind of cosmology that we see, the kinds of formations of, you know, galaxies and what the future holds for the universe, either one is fine. Like, nobody's been able to come up with a testable prediction that says, well, if we live in a finite universe, then we should see this. And if we live in an infinite universe, then we should see that. That you can't tell right now so far with the best measurements that anybody's ever done. It might be someday when somebody does like the most precise measurement of the cosmic microwave background radiation or some large scale structure in the universe and measures this just faint curvature to the universe and then uses that to predict the actual ultimate size of the universe. But we're not there yet. So we don't know whether we live in an infinite or a finite universe, and we don't know what the implications for cosmology are. MB Marty, do you personally believe that it's possible for a tidally locked planet around a red dwarf star in the Goldilocks zone of the planet could be enough for intelligent life to arise? So there's the situation where you've got planets that are orbiting around red dwarf stars and they're very close to the star. That's, you know, because the star is putting out less luminosity, less radiation than the sun is, you have to be much closer. It has a very thin habitable zone that you want to have your planet inside of. But astronomers have absolutely found examples of planets that are orbiting within that habitable zone of red dwarf stars. And then when you have a planet that is very close to the star, then almost certainly those planets are going to be tidally locked. And so one side of the planet is going to permanently face the star and one side is going to be facing away from the star. And so you're going to get this, you know, even though the entire planet is in the habitable zone and theoretically, you know, if it was turning, then you would have liquid water on the surface, or there's the potential for liquid water on the surface. But if it is tidally locked to the star, then things get a little weird, but not as weird as you might think. And so people have done simulations where they said, okay, what are the implications of being on a tidally locked planet around a red dwarf star, but in the habitable zone? And what they find is, yeah, the side that is facing away from the star, the one that is in eternal darkness, is extremely cold. You're going to get this sort of Arctic on the side that's away from the star. But then on the side that faces the star, you're not going to get this death desert. You're actually going to get something that's probably a lot more like a jungle. It's very, depends on the amount of water on the planet, but if it has a significant amount of water, it's going to be very cloudy, very jungly, very moist, humid. I guess jungle sort of implies it's going to be plants. But anyway, very humid. You're going to have clouds and humidity. It's going to be warm, but it's not going to be hundreds of degrees warm. It's going to be, you know, depending on the distance that you are, it's going to be temperate, like a jungle. And then you're going to get this very interesting region really close to the terminator. So sort of when you think about the two hemispheres of the planet, you have the one that's facing the star, the one that's facing away from the star. And then there's this like zone around the very edge of the planet. And that's going to be this sort of weird, interesting mix. But the place is going to be in twilight. And so it's not going to have a lot of illumination that's going to fall. But maybe the temperature is going to be this nice balance. You're probably also going to get very powerful winds that are going to be blowing from the near side to the far side. And I guess, you know, air will be circulating around. And that'll actually help to moderate the temperature on the far side of the planet. Could that be enough for intelligent life to arise? We have no idea. But that doesn't seem impossible to me, you know, that if you evolve on a world that is in eternal sunlight, but maybe has thick clouds and a ton of humidity, that seems like the kind of world that a species could evolve onto and eventually reach some kind of intelligent status. I mean, the ones that are going to be tough are like the ones that are going to be limited by how much they can do spacefaring are the ones that evolve on a world that is covered on a shell of ice that is 20 kilometers thick. The ones who live on a water world where the oceans are hundreds of kilometers deep and there's, you know, you can't start a fire anywhere. So being on one of these M dwarf worlds sounds relatively easy compared to the other possibilities that you could find out there. Sid Vicious, why do stars twinkle? I actually did a video on why stars twinkle, but I'll give you the short version, which is that it's due to the Earth's atmosphere we think of it as like just this invisible substance that we're just walking around in, but it is actually this gigantic column of air. And as light is moving through the atmosphere, it wobbles and gets distorted as it's making its way down to your eyeballs. And so from your perspective down on the ground, when you're looking up into space and you're looking at a star, you're seeing the position of that star being moved around by the combined distortions that's happening from the atmosphere. And so the twinkling is actually that star moving around. And so one of the things that's kind of interesting is that planets tend not to twinkle. They do twinkle a little bit. And that's because planets are little disks. Now, you can't see with your eyes, but if you look in a telescope or a pair of binoculars, you'll see the little disk. And so if you imagine that little disk that's being, you know, moved around from second to second, much of that planet's location is still in the same place. And so you're still seeing planet bits through the sky. And so they're a lot more stable. And if you talk to astronauts, when they fly out in space and they look up at the stars, they don't twinkle. They're all like planets and they're all very bright. It's kind of amazing to imagine what it would be like. Like that alone, to go to space and see the stars from space, like you're turning both of your eyeballs into space telescopes. That would be great. Sorry, Dory 78. Hey, Fraser, do you have suggestions for people like me who want to study astronomy seriously, but need to also keep their full-time jobs? I do. Yeah. So I think the first thing that you have to ask and answer for yourself is how important is the piece of paper, the degree, the diploma, the bachelor's degree, the master's degree, and the PhD, depending on how far along you want to take that. And I will propose, I want to sort of suggest that those things aren't very important. You know, I have a degree, but my degree is in computer science, not in astronomy. And, you know, I didn't go to get my master's and I didn't get my PhD. And so all of my work has been practical and it just has not been necessary. And yet I feel like I have, you know, a certain amount of astronomy knowledge. Because if you decide that you need the paper, you need to get the official diploma from Stanford or wherever you're going to go, then that is going to demand a certain level of financial investment, time investment, and an uncertainty of what's going to happen coming out the other side. And like, it's really hard to get a job as a professional astronomer. Like, each of those people who have gone through this program are the best of the best. And when they come out the other side, you've got 100 people competing for a job. It is really hard to become a professional astronomer, and they don't necessarily make much more money compared to other kinds of jobs. You know, the joke that I always make is, you know, if you fail to become a professional astronomer, then you can always take a backup job working for Google or some financial system, you know, as an analyst and make millions of dollars a year. So, if the paper isn't important to you, if the knowledge is the thing that's important to you, if contributing is important to you, then there are plenty of options. So astronomy is one of these fields where amateurs have just an outsized involvement in the science. So there are plenty of exoplanetary conformation studies you can do, variable star astronomy observing, asteroid discovery, comet discovery, supernova discovery. There's so many projects. And of course, all of these citizen science projects like Galaxy Zoo and CosmoQuest, where you can help out with various astronomical projects. And they require no astronomy knowledge, or they can require some astronomy knowledge. They can require no astronomy gear or some, you know, a telescope and a nice camera or whatever. And you can get as involved in it as you want. And then the other thing that I'm a huge fan of is getting the textbook and going through the textbook. You know, whatever is the course that you want to take, if it's an astronomy course, if it's an exoplanets course, if it's a calculus course, whatever, get the textbook, start at the beginning, read through at your own pace, whatever time you want, do the practice problems, make sure you're getting them right, move on to the next chapter, make sure you're getting them right. You will come out the other side of that process with the equivalent of an astronomy degree. You will understand how to do astronomy. You will understand all these pieces. You can read papers and understand and even make the same kinds of calculations. And then there are still even ways that you can contribute as an amateur to, you know, when some professional astronomer is looking to bring on other people to help with calculations, with observations, things like that. There are ways for you to find yourself into that. So I really think that a lot of people who love astronomy or the sciences, it's either or. Like they love astronomy, but only if they can get a degree. Don't get the degree. Don't worry about it. Like, everything is available online. You can do the equivalent of a degree at your own pace, learn this information, drop it when you're sick of it, and still keep your full-time job. So that's my recommendation. And who knows? Maybe it turns into a career for you later on. Eerie, is there such a thing as a rogue gravity wave? That's a great question. Like a rogue wave, this is where you get multiple waves where they're, you know, there's some kind of, maybe they're going around some rock in the ocean, or there's some kind of weird amplitude. And so you get to add together the peaks of two waves together, and you get a wave that is dramatically larger. And now we've got satellites in space that are mapping the surface of the Earth, and they're actually spotting rogue waves, you know, legendary waves that have capsized ocean liners, or, you know, ships have disappeared and said, oh, it was probably a rogue wave. And occasionally they've been seen at lighthouses and things like that. But now satellites are spotting them, counting them, mapping them. They're terrifying, I think. You know, if you're going to be a sailor and try and cross an ocean, I'm sure some part of your brain is always thinking about rogue waves. So would rogue waves work in space with gravity waves? And theoretically, sure. That if you've got two separate objects that simultaneously are releasing gravitational waves, so you've got two neutron stars that are colliding in far apart from each other, you know, two sets of neutron stars, then they're going to release gravitational waves. And as the gravitational waves go past each other, then you're going to get these interactions between the waves. You're going to get places where the peaks add together. You're going to have places where the troughs subtract from one another. And so, yeah, you're absolutely going to get, but like gravitational waves, especially the distances that we have here at Earth, they are so subtle. Like, it's hard to get across how minute the effect is of a gravitational wave passing through the Earth. It is not like we are being stretched and torn apart as a gravitational wave moves by. It is as if there is this microscopic change on the radius of the entire planet Earth as the gravity wave goes past. But yeah, wherever gravitational waves interact with each other, you're going to get these similar to ocean waves. Apropos of wet snow, do you think the scientific method is innately tied to Homo sapiens' peculiar sensory setup? Would aliens with different neural systems understand science differently? Clearly, the scientific method is something that is our natural instinct as human beings. We try something, we gather data about that thing, and then we form some kind of conclusion. Now, we can do the science badly, and, you know, really it wasn't until the scientific method was really formalized that we figured out how to do the difference between doing science well and doing science badly. But I mean, any kind of other intelligent civilization is going to be living in the universe. They're going to be harvesting energy, and they're going to be using matter. And so you would need some way of discerning what is true and what is false in the universe. And the scientific method is the way you do that. You run an experiment, you see the results. If the results are successful, then that gives you credence that your theory was correct. You know, if you can disprove your hypothesis, then you can throw it out. And that doesn't feel like it's a specific cultural thing, that you could ask somebody in another culture that's never had any experience with the scientific method, and you taught them how to use it, then, or they could come up with it on their own, and they would uncover the results, the raw results of, or the raw laws of nature in the way that we do. And you can think about the kinds of discoveries that have been made around the Earth. The same discovery was made by different societies, because at the end of the day, nature is the ultimate arbiter of what is true and what is false. And so, yeah, I can't imagine that the scientific method would work any differently for any other society. Like, I can imagine better versions of, like, when you think about double-blind studies or learning statistics and so that, you're doing the scientific method better, but, you know, you're sort of imagining what is the kind of platonic ideal of the scientific method to perfectly inquire to nature its truths. And that just feels like the scientific method is the way. All right. Those are all the questions that we had this week. Thank you, everyone who asked your questions in the YouTube comments. Everyone who showed up for the live show. We record this show live every Monday at 5 p.m. Pacific time right here on the YouTube channel. So if you want to participate in that, it's twice as long. It's like 2 hours long. And there's a lot of back and forth, very fun chat. So definitely come and check that out. Now, I'm going to give you an update on the book club as well as a recommendation for a small YouTube channel. But first, I'd like to thank our patrons. Thanks to Abe Kingston, Adam Schaefer, David Giltinen, David Matz, Dennis Alberti, Dustin Cable, Jeremy Mattern, Jim Burke, Jordan Young, Josh Schultz, Modso, Paul Rohrbach, Stephen Grisaki, Stephen Filer Munley, and Vlad Chiplin, who support us at the Master of the Universe level, and all of our patrons. All your support means the universe to us. All right, I've got a two for this week, which is that I'm going to give you an update on the book club. I finally read one of the books that everybody has been asking me to read, and that is the first book in the Discworld series by Terry Pratchett, The Color of Magic. And this is the beginning of like 45 books, and I'm not sure how many of them I'm going to be able to get through, but I read the first one. What did I think about it? It was fine. I didn't love it. And I'm sure like the people who are like giant fans of Terry Pratchett are like, there's so many other good books. Like these are the good ones and those are the bad ones. And no problem. I will find my way through these. But it was a solid fantasy novel with some really clever ideas. It was hilarious. I enjoyed my time with the book, but it didn't feel transcendent, but it felt like a fantasy writer who's just kind of getting his footing and starting to figure out this, and very funny and clever ideas. So, you know, and Good Omens, written with Neil Gaiman, is one of my absolute favorite books. And so I have faith in Terry. So I'm, you know, I'll keep going. And then I want to recommend a small YouTuber. I'm still looking for YouTubers that don't have a lot of followers. So this week I want to recommend Marion Kerr. And she has hosted several science documentaries on YouTube and has been doing a series of space videos that are very topical and are really good. And they don't get a lot of traffic. She just did a great video on the Dragonfly mission. She has less than 3,000 subscribers. This is madness. So if you haven't already, I'll put a link in the show notes. Go and follow Marion Kerr. Show her some support and give her some enthusiasm, encouragement for producing really good space videos here on YouTube. All right. We will see you all next week.